Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. In his characteristically deadpan fashion, Stephen Wright has been making people laugh for more than four decades.
When I was in high school, I worked in a pet store and they fired me because what happened was they had three snakes in there and one day I braided them.
Over the course of his career, he's won an Oscar and been nominated for Grammy and Emmy Awards while working regularly in movies and on TV. Throughout it all, Wright has remained a fixture on the road. His stand-up tour comes to Ulster Performing Arts Center in Kingston on Friday night, and it's my pleasure to welcome Stephen Wright back to the Roundtable. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. I know you don't love doing interviews, so thanks for doing this one. How's your approach to your live show changed, if at all, over the time you've been doing it?
Well, first of all, it's kind of the same. It's just a matter of, you know, writing is thinking, and I'm always thinking, so it's like, it's just a matter of weeding out what works and what doesn't work, and I do that in front of an audience, during my shows on the road, I try material out. It's the same as from an open mic night in the beginning till now, he's trying out stuff and throwing away the stuff that doesn't work. It's basically the same. I mean, I'm more comfortable out there, but it's the same concept.
What percentage of stuff you try actually makes it into the show?
Great question. Only 1 in 3 jokes or 1 in 4 that I write will get a big enough left to stay in. So, you know, I try it 3 nights. If it doesn't work, it'll never work. And then if it works 3 nights, then I can count on it. So for every 3 I write, only 1 is good enough to stay. But like when I do that show in Kingston, I mean, I'll be doing material that I already know works, except I'll try a couple during the show. So it's like a baseball player, really. If a guy's batting 300, that's good. But that means he didn't get a hit 7 times. So, and it's been the same ratio the whole time.
Do you ever disagree with the audience? Like, do you try something and you're shocked that it doesn't work?
These are really good questions. People don't ask me these questions. I can't predict. I've been doing it for 40 years, and I can't predict which ones they're going to laugh at. If I think of something funny, I write it down because I think it's funny. And then if they don't laugh, say, for instance, they don't laugh at 3 nights, I don't think I was wrong. I still think it's funny. They just don't agree with me. But the audience in charge, you know, they're like editing the show. And I cannot predict which ones are going to work at all, ever.
It also seems to me that you have to write way more jokes than the average comedian, because a lot of people are trending more toward doing monologues and kind of long set pieces, whereas you might tell 10 jokes in 1 minute with your sort of one-liner approach.
Yes, that is true, but that's the only way I've ever done it, so it's normal, but I know what you're saying. For some reason, my concept was to say the fewest words as possible to get the point across. And I don't, there's no fluff. It's just like one joke right after another, but I know what you mean. Like, a 5-minute TV appearance would have about 23 jokes. And I do an 80-minute show, so there's like, I don't know how many jokes are in that, like hundreds. But it, you know, a joke, even if they laugh at the joke, it's including the laugh is probably 10 seconds.
I don't know if you've seen that documentary made about Joan Rivers late in her life, but there's a really fascinating part of it where she shows a filing cabinet and she's got all of her jokes from her career by subject matter, and they're filed away and then she can revisit them. And I was wondering if, you know, you've written thousands of jokes. Do you have like a database of them, or do they just fall away after a while? How do you keep track?
I did see that documentary and I did notice that exact part, and I was blown away by the organization of it. I wish I had something like that, but I don't have that. I've started out drawing. My first creative thing was drawing. So I like notebooks, drawing notebooks that have no lines on them. So, I mean, I've been writing, and now I write into the phone. It's all written in the phone. But as far as, like, what she did, mine is very red, just like a table or a couple of tables with scattered notebooks full of random. It's not organized at all. It's just all written, handwritten. So I got an iPhone. It's not like hers at all. It's like chaotic.
I hear some regret over that.
No, not really. It's how it is.
So where does your sense of humor come from?
You know, you asked some really good questions. I'm not just saying that. I have no idea. I don't know where you're asking me at the process of why do I have a sense of humor. I don't know why. But I know to get the humor is watching the world. It's all from that, you know. But everyone's head is like a soup. It's mixed up with different things. I love Johnny Carson. I love the comedian on there. I loved comedy albums when I grew up, George Carlin. I love Monty Python. I love Salvador Dali. I love Kurt Vonnegut. I love Woody Allen, you know, and then all that gets mixed in your head. Surrealism, Kowski, all different things, all mixed together. And then there's my actual brain itself, and then it's all mixed. My father was a regular guy. Mother was a regular person. They weren't extremely funny. They were average, so it didn't come from there. Are you still there?
Oh, yeah, listening. And you came up in Boston, which in that era has a legendary reputation for being a very fertile area for stand-up and for comedians. How did beginning there impact you?
Well, I started in 79, and the club had only been there a year. And starting there was fantastic because there was no show business in... I'm not putting show business... wasn't business now, but there was no show business in Boston. There was no managers or agents or producers or anyone in the sense of to tell you that you should do this way. We were like on an island. It was like it had nothing to do with the actual business. It was like a laboratory of learning how to do it. So the lack of outside criticism or his suggestion was worked out to be fantastic because we were just doing it on our own, figuring how to do it on our own. And all the comedians from that time and still guys doing it now are very different than each other. Dennis Leary, Lenny Clark, Steve Sweeney, Kevin Meaney when he was around, All these different people. It's like they're not one of them like the other one. Mike McDonald, Mike Donovan, Don Gavin, Bob Goldthwait, Paula Poundstone. It was just the isolation worked out in the long run. By the time anyone saw us from show business, we'd already developed our way of doing it.
What was your vision or your goal for what your career would be when you got started?
My goal, I started watching The Tonight Show when I was 16, and I was watching it all the time, almost every night, and saw Carlin on there and Pryor. And my goal for my life, my dream, was to go on that show. That was my whole dream, and then to go on like maybe a couple of times. And then I went on in August of 82. And still, that's my favorite thing I ever did in show business. So now doing it like 40 years, I didn't even, it's not that I wanted to do it or didn't want to do it. It just, that's just what happened. I like doing it. I like making stuff up. It's like being in kindergarten. It's playing. Thoughts are like words and jokes are like playing. It's like finger painting, but except with concepts. And the fact that some people like it and want to come to the show, it's fantastic.
What did you think of Mitch Hedberg?
I saw that he was absolutely influenced by me, and I thought that he was really, really funny, and I wish that I had thought of some of the jokes that he came up with. Yeah, I that's what I thought of him. Very smart guy, very fun guy.
I know you're a big Red Sox fan. What do you think about all the turmoil happening now that Alex Cora is out as manager?
You know, that's very sad that they maybe cheated. And, you know, and all the Patriot accusations. But the baseball, that was very disappointing to hear that. I mean, I've been following baseball since I was little. You know, Yastrzemski and all that, all those. But, you know, the world, you just can't, you know, it's, you know, you see a documentary, they're making a Western movie, and the front of the buildings are all just real, but behind it, there's nothing. There's just, like, something holding up the back of, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I mean, it goes all the way to the Kennedy. I'm connecting Alex Cora to Kennedy. When I grew up, he was looked at as Jesus. Kennedy was Jesus. And then when I got older, I realized that his father made all the money bootlegging. He bought the presidency through the mafia in Chicago. And it's, oh, my God, he's not Jesus. So it's just another one. It's just another one.
Well, logically, I have to ask you what you think of the current White House occupant then.
Oh, here's my answer. Oh. I have several things that I say to my friends that I don't want to say publicly. But I'm glad you asked me that because I love my answer to you. I didn't say, and there were no words, but it was like 10 million words. Oh.
Stephen Wright is coming back to our region on Friday. He'll be at Ulster Performing Arts Center in Kingston, New York. Stephen, it's been really fun having a chance to ask you some questions, and thanks for taking them in good humor.
Thank you. It was fun doing the interview. Thank you.
Yesterday, I returned a movie. The people at the theater were pissed. So I rented a movie, I put it in DVD player, and before the movie starts, it says, this film has been modified to fit your television. Can you imagine if it wasn't? All you'd see is like a knuckle. So I'm driving down the highway. There's a guy hitchhiking. He's holding a sign that says heaven. So I hit him.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.